Jim Alcoholic.
Hey, Jim.
It's good to be here. It's good to be sober. I've known Eric since, well, for a while now. I've seen Eric come and go. We coined the name. I'm not sure who coined the name, but 48 Hours was his name for a while. And I was like, when I first heard it, I said, what does that mean? Said, well, it's his sobriety date. And... But it's good to see Eric. He's getting more and more involved as time goes by. He's come and speak on some commitments and just about ready to do his fifth step, at least for last year. But no, it's good to get to know Eric, and he's certainly grown by leaps and bounds and. Is showing up, and that's all anybody ever does, try to help another alcoholic and show up, and I've seen him try to help a number of people that were as bad as he was, if not worse, and drag them around a bit. So anyway, I don't have a medallion for you, but
appreciate it. Thanks. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Eric.
Hey, Eric.
And I'm a slow learner. So, in 2004, after 26 years of drinking and drugging, I went to a detox. And the day I came out, I drank and drugged. After 28 days in a very expensive Minnesota detox rehab. And that started like this journey of coming around the rooms, kind of fumbling around AA, kind of as a guest, and constantly relapsing, habitual relapser. And I remember coming into the sponsorship group probably about 9 or 10 months around the area, and I heard these guys are serious and they get you on your step work. Out of the big book, going on commitments, and I wanted no part of it. I wanted no part of it because it meant that I had to get serious and do the work. And I kind of had reservations because I was constantly relapsing. The fuck wants to do? Excuse me, sorry. Who wants to do all the work while you're high? I could sit back in the room and listen to some and really enjoy what I was hearing. But, I'd leave and go get high. I think I got, like, in 2008, after some serious pain, and it was all internal. I still had an apartment. I didn't really lose much. I had a lot of enablers, helping pay the rent. I got about 4 or 5 months sober, which was huge for me. But I still wasn't really doing the work. And I went and chased a girl in Mexico. And to get on a plane, I have to get high. So, I got high, and I spent the reverse of rehab. I spent 28 days in Mexico getting high. And I was fortunate enough to be able to spend that time there. I never did meet the girl, but that's what I was. I'm a selfish person who is delusional at most of the time and thinks that what I conjure up in my head is real, and I'll go on that. Last July, I came back. I asked somebody to help me. And they said they really can't help me till I get a few days of dry time, And I was ready to follow directions, and that's really what I've been doing. And I got to say that, although I've never been homeless, I've always had the enablers around me. That this last year of working the steps, and I did kind of stall on my fourth step. But You know, I still come to meetings at least 5 days a week. Jim mentioned I've been, you know, asking where they're going so I can go out with them as much as possible. I own a real estate company, so I am very busy. But this is the most important thing. And if I put anything in front of my sobriety, I'm going to lose it. You know, I've seen it happen before. And I know in this last year, I've gotten so much. And it's not the business. It's not, you know, I don't have any worldly possessions. It's more inside and a connection with my higher power. And I look forward, if I ever sit down for like 2 hours, to finish my fourth step, to get my fifth underway and, you know, do it and go right through the rest of the steps and start helping other people. And, you know, Jim has worked with me a little bit on the fourth step, trying to kick me in the butt. And, you know, I'm going to keep coming. And it's an amazing journey. And if you're new or you're coming back, grab on to someone. And, you know, this is one of the most amazing groups. You know, I have brought a few people by. I've introduced a few really sick and suffering people to Jim, because I know that, you know what, I was afraid of, which was to get serious and to get down to work, I know that some people, you know, they know it. I know it, that they need that. So I introduced them to Jim. And if you're serious about getting sober, come around the sponsorship group, because you'll learn a lot and you'll do a lot. And I think that's what really, you know, keeps you walking the walk. That's all I have. Thanks.
And tonight's speaker is Dennis.
I'm Dennis, I'm an alcoholic.
Dennis!
And I always like helping other alcoholics. So on the way here, I got earplugs for, you know, if someone really needs them. Anyway, as an alcoholic, I really don't like following directions, but, you know, coming drunk to AA for 2 years, sometimes you figure out, hey, maybe I should try the directions. And so I'm going to try to briefly tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And that's kind of how the directions read. We share our story in a general way. And with me, before I started drinking alcohol, I had a childhood where both my parents were immigrated from Ireland, and they both didn't drink. They, I guess, experienced alcoholism somewhere in their childhood, you know, especially since my mom's dad died on the way home from the pub. And, you know, they both joined the Pioneers, which is an organization in Ireland where you swear off alcohol for life. And, you know, later on I'm thinking, boy, they never even gave it a chance. But, you know, in the environment I was in, they had, you know, people in the family that were drinkers, because large Irish families, and so they always had alcohol in the house. And when I was about 11 years old, we had family get-togethers, and this one, my cousin Ron, came from New York, and, you know, he was a little wild, and we were playing darts downstairs, and he threw a dart, and it sailed past the dartboard and hit this bottle of scotch, and the thing, I could remember it coming down all three shelves and dripping down. And, you know, I noticed that some people were making a big deal over this, so I got it in my mind, there's something good in there, you know. And, you know, growing up with the fears that I just naturally had, you know, I was a little apprehensive about drinking this stuff, so I took some down a couple of days later, and I gave it to my 7-year-old brother, see what it did to him. You know? And it really, you know, didn't kill him, so I gave it a shot, and I could tell you the first sip was a little bit rough. I never really did develop a taste for scotch, but just to give you a little comparison, when I was 5 years old, my mother had given me a Brussels sprout, and I thought it tasted nasty, and to this day, I've never had another Brussels sprout, you know, but within a minute, I had that bottle up to my mouth again, and I have no idea why, because it really tasted nasty. But I drank some more, and I don't remember the effect that I got from it. But I know soon after that, I got into the beer, you know, not the same day. And the beer, I kind of had the same effect, but it didn't have the burn of whiskey. So I was able to get down a whole beer and start on the second one. And I tell you, by the second one, it started tasting good. You know, I developed a taste for beer, and I, you know, I love booze. from the time I was 11 years old. And being 11 years old, I didn't get to drink it a whole lot. But, you know, I didn't miss any opportunities, that's for sure. You know, if there was a family get-together and they weren't going to miss some booze, it was getting to me. In fact, I think it was like I was 12 years old. I think I experienced my first blackout at a party that it was actually my oldest cousin's wedding, and they had left champagne glasses on all the tables, like an outside affair. And, you know, I convinced some of the other cousins that it'd be a great idea if we had a champagne drinking contest, you know, and seeing how many glasses of champagne we could swipe. And I was the winner. I think I got 17 of them down. And I had a blackout, puked on myself. And this is back in the 70s. And, you know, that baggy pants style hadn't come in yet. But after I puked myself and they threw me in the car, you know, I found a pair of pants in there that were my father's. And I was a small kid. So I think I started that trend with the baggy pants. And I went back out to get some... went back out, and my cousin had got me some rum and cokes, and I started drinking some more. So after puking and passing out and waking back up, I wanted some more booze. So I know there's parts in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that talk about social drinkers that later develop into alcoholic, and that wasn't my experience. I was pretty much alcoholic from when I got alcohol. And, you know, I learned a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned that I had a different reaction from other people. I actually know people that... you know, we'll have a drink and not even finish it, you know? And that, to me, is an abnormal reaction, but that's only from my perspective. What I have is an abnormal reaction. I drink it, and I need some more. You know, I just love to drink. And I noticed something about the booze. You know, when I was growing up, I was considered a shy kid. I got in my share of trouble, but I was sneaky about it. You know, I really didn't have that sense of self-worth where I can, you know, definitely when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not stand in front of people and talk. That just wasn't happening. I just had too much self-conscious fear, and it was just me thinking about me, thinking about what you thought about me, and just none of that was occurring. But I noticed when I drank the booze, you know, I didn't become talkative, but I didn't have that feeling of, you know, what are you thinking about me? That went away. I mean, booze just took care of that. You know, I didn't care anymore. And I noticed as I drank longer, you know, there were certain morals that my parents tried to instill upon me when I was young, which never really stuck, but, you know, I adhered to them a little bit until I started drinking. And then it was like, you know, what I wanted to do is what I did. You know, of course, there's consequences, and, you know, my parents were also very good enablers. They would, frequently have to get me an expensive attorney so that I didn't have to do any jail time. And, you know, until they went to that stupid Al-Anon thing, and then they wouldn't come bail me out on the first day. You know, they weren't real good in Al-Anon either, because they'd come on the second day with the bail money. So they were slow learners, too. But anyway, throughout my drinking, there were certain drinking episodes. And if you're at that meeting, you probably... had some of the experiences that drinkers have when they drink, you know, what other people would call excessively. I wouldn't call it excessively. You know, my idea of excessive, well, I didn't have an idea of excessive drinking. I just drank, you know. When the booze was out, you know, I went for more, you know, by whatever means necessary. And, you know, as my drinking progressed, I learned there was a lot of people that drank like that and liked to drink like that, and those are the people I hung out with. You know, so from the standpoint of what they tell us in the book, you know, to us, our drinking seems the only normal life. Well, to me, that was so true because the people around me were drinking like me, or they weren't around me for long. I actually came to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time so I can continue drinking. You know, AA had been helping me along the way with my drinking. You know, like when I was 16, I woke up out of a blackout and someone shoved an AA pamphlet in my pocket. And it was, you know, which, you know, it happened a few more times, but that's the first time I remembered it. And they had a series of questions on, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? You know, determining if you're an alcoholic or not. And I really like to score good on tests, and I did throughout, you know, my schooling and all that stuff. But this one, there was... there might have been 10 questions. I'm not sure how many there was, but I think there was about 10, and I got like 8 out of 10 that said, if you answered like 3 of them, you're probably alcoholic. But I got about 8 out of 10. And one of them that I didn't answer yes to was, do you drink in the morning? You know? And I looked at that and I was like, you know, I never really thought about drinking in the morning, but it sounds like a good idea. And so the next day I started drinking in the morning. And so AA's been helping me out long before I came here, you know, because when I discovered morning drinking, it was awesome, you know. You got to wait around till when to drink? Why not start first thing, you know? And it was great. But, you know, AA, when I was told about Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a guy, Pete, that I'd been hanging out with. And, you know, my parents, they didn't put up with a lot of my crap. And by the time I was 16, usually in the summer, I was kicked out for the summer, you know, just go find somewhere else. And I didn't really have very many social skills, so I was pretty much living on the street. You know, I didn't have friends that I could crash on their couch or anything like that. Or, you know, and so actually some of my friends, their parents would prefer it if they didn't hang out with me. So I couldn't go to their house. And so I'd live on the street, sometimes abandoned bus, sometimes a equipment shed that they had at the Roseville Catholic field there. And, you know, so there was this guy that lived across the street from me that was about 5 years older than me, maybe 5 or 6 years older. And, you know, he had the house that all the police used to show up to, you know, until, you know, I got old enough, and then they would just show up at my house. But both his parents had passed away, and there was 4 kids, and he was like the only one that really lived there. The rest of them had a place. And so it was a good place to crash and drink and do drugs and whatever we needed to do. But I hadn't seen him for a number of months. And as it turns out, he got caught with a gun that wasn't registered to him. So the state of New Jersey frowns on that. So they locked him up. 1 second. They gave him like a 6-month bid in the county jail. And, you know, Pete, he was a smart guy. They came to him after 2 months and offered him this deal. They said, look, you can do your last 4 months here, or we can give you 28 days at Johnny Reynolds Hospital, you know, which was a rehab facility. And, you know, Pete did the math, you know, 28 days, 4 months. 28 days was shorter, so he took the 28 days, and they introduced him to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, he didn't, you know, he stopped drinking. He didn't stop smoking pot or any of the other stuff, but he stopped drinking. But that was my first 12 step. He said, Dennis, you know, like, he knew I always had court charges pending. You know, there was always something. If I got rid of one, I had another one pending usually. And so this is how Pete put his 12 step call on me. He says, you know, Dennis, if you go to AA and tell the judge you're going to AA, he won't give you any jail time. You know, so AA, you know, I never had a really high opinion of you guys, but I started thinking maybe AA is not so bad. And as it turns out, in the mid 80s, I don't know how court goes nowadays, luckily, because of AA, but back in the 80s, they took forever when they charged you with something to actually get you to court. You know, it's usually a couple of appearances. You got to go for a plea and then get back and everything. And I don't know if I'd even done the plea by that point. So when he said AA and I thought it was a good idea, I thought I'm going to dodge this guy for a couple of months, and that's what I did. You know, oh, thank you so much. And so I dodged him for a bit, and then finally when you know, it seemed like the court date was kind of close, I figured maybe I'd better meet him at this AA meeting. And so I went up to Roseville Sunday night meeting, and it was huge. I mean, there was about 300 people back then. That's when the church allowed smoking inside. And it was real anonymity because it was so thick, the smoke, you couldn't see somebody 3 rows over. And I got to this meeting, and, you know, I really didn't think anything about me having alcoholism, you know, because I had an idea in my mind of what an alcoholic was, and it was definitely someone older than 20, you know. But I went to the meeting and I listened to what they had to say. And at that meeting, there was even a girl I had drank with. She dated a buddy of mine, and she was 19. And, you know, I knew her, and I met her right at the first meeting. So, I mean, that idea of being too young to be an Alcoholics Anonymous was kind of wiped out. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have that idea that, and I really didn't get the message about the book Alcoholics Anonymous and what we need to do to stay sober and that, but it might have been offered because I really wasn't looking for it. You know, I wasn't listening for that kind of thing. And I just wanted to avoid some jail time, and that's what I did. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was given some suggestions, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I figured that really didn't apply to me, and I did about 90. You know, and they said, get a sponsor. And, you know, I really didn't think that was a good idea either. But the guy Pete I was telling you about, he had a tattoo on his face. And, you know, that's the kind of person I listen to. So he told me, ask Neil to be my sponsor. So that's what I did. So and it, as it turned out, it was good because I didn't have a driver's license. And Neil would pick me up for the meetings. So it worked out nice at the time. And then later on, when I got my driver's license and my motorcycle ran out of gas, I can call him up because he had a pickup truck, you know. But as far as, you know, doing any steps or any of that stuff, that didn't interest me. It didn't apply to me, actually. This is what I thought. So I went to these 90 meetings in 90 days. And I think it was about 100 meetings into it. You know, I was down in my mother's basement, and I was hitting a heavy bag down there, and I look over, and there's a little shelf, and there was a pot pipe there, and I don't think it was my parents. I think it was one I had lost earlier because they didn't smoke pot. But I picked it up and lit it, and I had no intentions really of, you know, using any drugs or getting booze or any of that stuff, but it was just so natural. You know, I didn't have any solution to my life. What I had was a little reprieve, and I was also still looking at jail time, so I was trying to behave myself. And I was going to these meetings, and they didn't want to hear about drugs in the meetings. And I, you know, immediately thought, good, because now I don't have to stop doing them, because they don't want to hear about it. So, I, you know, that was what Alcoholics Anonymous consisted of for me. I'd go to meetings, and this guy, Pete, who 12-stepped me, was also kind of a little bit of a pot smoker. Later on, he'd shoot up a little heroin, too. I think he was a social user, though. But my ideas of Alcoholics Anonymous were just, you know, show up at meetings. And, you know, I didn't stay, I stayed off of booze for over 11 months. But, you know, after 2 or 3 months of smoking pot, because after that first, and it was really weird, it was subtle. I smoked pot, I didn't smoke pot again for another 2 months, you know, until I taught my little brother how to roll joints, too. And I knew he had some, so I started smoking with him like 2 months later. But I never did any of the work in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really, what I wanted was to just go to enough meetings so that the police would see me going there, because I had received a suspended sentence somewhere in that 11 months. And so it meant I couldn't get caught for a year. I was going to do a little jail time, which I'd been to jail before, and I really wasn't adverse to it. But, you know, I didn't like being locked up, and I was trying to avoid it. So after about 11 months, I started drinking again. And, you know, there was one of the things that I can say the first time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was I was encouraged to read the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about there being directions on how to actually stay sober or descriptions of what an alcoholic was or anything like that, but I did read through it. So when I went back on this drinking, and I immediately stopped going to AA meetings because, you know, I would go when I'm doing drugs, but if I'm drinking, look, I'm not going to AA. I don't want to be a hypocrite. So so I was back out to drinking full time and not going to meetings. And, you know, the consequences always kind of changed with the progression of my illness. And, you know, whereas certain points, you know, I couldn't stop, like, entirely. At times I could stop drinking. Sometimes I just couldn't. But I was having other consequences, you know. Sometimes it wasn't jail. Also, when the first time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I really wasn't too keen on keeping a job or anything like that. I preferred illegal activities, maybe selling drugs, maybe breaking into places, something else to fund my partying, you know. But when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I learned that all these alcoholics kept jobs, and they were excellent sources of drinking money. So AA taught me how to keep a job the first time in, which was nice. So actually, when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had two jobs, and I wasn't such a criminal. Once in a while, but I just dabbled, which is nice because it also shortened my 9-step amends list, you know, by being off of most of the criminal activity the second time around. But I was having these other things where my language skills were really poor. You know, I had done a little stint down at the State University of Rutgers, and they do admission testing, and I tested really high in math, but like the bottom 2% for English. You know, so the communication skills were kind of, you know, I didn't like asking what words were. I just, you know, made up something that sounded good to me. And it didn't mean the same thing as what someone else understood the word to be. So as a result, when I drank, if I disagreed with someone, I really couldn't argue over it. What I like to do is wait till they're not looking and hit them. And, you know, as a result, you know, the people that I drank with, you know, they never stayed in my life for very long. And I was hanging out with this one guy, Richie, who was a linebacker for Iowa State University at the time. He'd been drafted. He was really good, rather violent kid, and I was hanging out with him, and I knew I'd never get drunk enough to hit Richie, and, you know, so it was all right for me to drink with him. And this one night in June of 88, I was hanging out, and I didn't remember what happened. I woke up, my hands were closed, they were all covered in blood. I had to pry my fingers open. I had little rocks in it and everything. And I didn't know what happened. I just knew I was hanging out with Richie and something happened. And I called him up and he said, "You tried to beat me up last night." And it, you know, I didn't, it really baffled me because, you know, I didn't, you know, I knew I wouldn't hit him. You know, there's a couple of people I hung out with that I wouldn't hit, and Richie was one of them. And I thought, you know, this drink is really going to kill me, you know. Now, when I read that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the first time in, I understood that they have a difference between a heavy drinker and an alcoholic. And sometimes they look the same from the outside, but a heavy drinker, given sufficient reason, can stop or moderate, you know? And getting locked up, not really sufficient reason, you know, or having my family not want to be around me. I wasn't too crazy about them anyway, so, you know, any of the consequences in my life, you know, I learned to live with. You know, it was a small price to pay to be drunk all the time. But if it's going to kill me to keep drinking, you know, that's beyond what I was willing to pay. You know, I wasn't suicidal. I can't ever remember being suicidal. And, you know, I mean, there was that time I was hitchhiking on the center lane in the turnpike, but I really was just trying to get a ride. You know, you might have thought I was suicidal, but I wasn't. So I knew I had to stop drinking, and I stopped drinking. And it was 2 weeks without any booze in my system. You know, it was clear from my system. And I'm hanging out with my brother's friends because, of course, Richie was like my last friend, and he was even hesitant to hang with me anymore. And they were going to graduation parties. They were all graduating high school, and they were good drinkers. They went to these two keg parties, and I didn't even sit near the kegs, you know. I didn't have any booze at all. And afterwards, they're going to the golf course over in Roselle. They're going to get a couple of cases of beer and hang out. And so I gave the big kid, he was like 6'4", had been getting served since he was 16. I gave him, you know, money for soda. And he goes over to the liquor store, he comes out, he didn't get any soda, you know. And, you know, I had no intentions of drinking. I knew it was a bad idea for me. And I just cracked the beer and just started drinking, you know. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea, you know. And about the third or fourth beer, they decided they would steal some golf carts out of the golf course, but we'd been hanging there for years, and we knew that if you want to steal the golf carts, you got to bring your own spark plugs, because they take them out, because we'd been stealing them for years. So they removed the spark plugs at night, and they didn't know that, so I didn't want to explain it to them, whatever. Let them have their fun. I'll be over here drinking. And me and this other kid, Kenny, are sitting on the bench, and they, I guess they're getting tired of pushing this golf cart and trying to get it started with no spark plugs. It's not going to start. So they get another bright idea. They say, "Hey, let's ram the bench that they're sitting on." You know, and I'm sitting there, and I just caught it out of the corner of my eye, and I grabbed my beer and jumped up. And, you know, the first thing that came to mind is they almost spilt my beer, and I was pissed. And I had some words with them, and somehow they just left and left all the beer, and I was by myself with the there was a case and a half of beer left, and I was by myself. and I knew about my condition for the first time. You know, I knew I didn't want to drink. You know, I really didn't want to drink. And there I was drinking. And I looked around, I said, this doesn't look like social drinking. Not that I ever confused what I did with social drinking. I really wasn't very social. I just liked to drink. But I knew for the first time what my condition was. You know, my strongest desire to not drink was of no avail. I have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, the memory of the suffering of a week or a month ago. In my case, it was 2 weeks. 2 weeks. I can't remember that this stuff's going to kill me. You know, I mean, if I was suicidal, it would make perfect sense. Go drink. But I wasn't, you know. On rare occasions, a little homicidal, but never suicidal. And I know. And I'd been Alcoholics Anonymous before. You know, what I didn't realize is, you know, say I want to go learn how to cook something. Say I want to learn how to cook a cake. And I go to a cooking class. And they tell me instructions on how to cook a cake. Right? And they tell me I got to break some eggs and put it. No, I don't want to break any eggs. You know, well, my cake is pretty much going to taste like shit. I mean, I don't know how to bake for nothing, but I'm just assuming you put eggs in cake. But but I had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't follow any of the directions, you know. And I tell you what, since being in Alcoholics Anonymous and going through the directions, some of these sorry-ass meetings, they won't even give you the directions. You know, some people stand up here and tell you they used to drink, you know, and now they don't and life is better, and not tell you how they accomplished that. That's just cruel. You know? But, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't follow any of the directions. So when I had that understanding that I really don't think AA is going to work for me, because what I did was I took that case and a half of beer and I stashed it in my mother's shed. And I didn't want to drink it, but I knew eventually I was going to need to. And I'm a little cheap, you know. If I got something for free, I'm not going to pay for it. So I had it stashed. And I also knew that in the summertime, if you leave beer outside, which was rare for me because I drank it as soon as I got it usually, but if you leave it outside and it's there for a while, it'll heat up and cool off, and it's going to taste a little skunky, you know. But I didn't care. You know, booze is booze, and when I need booze, I don't care what's in it. I haven't gone as far as drinking mouthwash yet, thankfully, but I would do it. I drank NyQuil. You know, that stuff was nice. Only they said it's supposed to, you know, the sniffling, sneezing, so you can drink medicine. But when I drink it, I'm up. I'm looking for some six packs, you know. False advertising. But maybe that's what it does to a non-alcoholic. I don't know. I'm not in their shoes. So anyway, I didn't think AA was going to work. And I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to meetings, and you know, when they suggested do 90 meetings in 90 days, you know, when they suggested that, I didn't question it because I didn't know any better. And I did a lot of meetings. I think my first 90 days sober, I might have done 120 meetings if I had a guess at it, because I was still working two jobs, but when I had a day off, I was doing two or three meetings a day because I didn't trust me, you know. I learned that I know something's going to kill me and I don't want to die and I'm doing it anyway. My brain is unreliable, you know. It's alcoholism, you know, or maybe a little mental illness mixed in, but definitely definitely alcoholism. And I came back to AA. I didn't give AA much chance of working on me. I knew people that hadn't drank in years. You know, I wasn't sure they drank like me. And some of them didn't really seem to be happy about being sober either. But I was at this meeting in Roselle on a Monday night. Yeah, the Monday night in Roselle, and there was a guy that came there, and he wasn't from the area, and he was 3 years without a drink, and he was freaking overjoyed about it, which I didn't understand, you know, and he was real real comfortable in his own skin, and you could tell, and he offered a solution, and he talked about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous through experience and actually going through the directions in it, and it was something I hadn't heard in any of the other meetings. Not that it might have not have been mentioned, but my listening skills were really poor, worse than they are today. But, you know, I heard this guy, and I really wanted what he had. And, you know, he talked about a very simple method of getting it. You know, not easy, but simple. You know, something that anyone can do. And it was written out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way he described it made it sound appealing. And I still had my first sponsor that I came in with, and you know, I really liked him. I admired him. He had one of the funniest stories you ever hear in AA. If you ever get a chance to hear him, it's entertaining. You know, but he rode with some outlaw clubs, and he had stories about like strapping a shotgun to his handlebars and riding with a few pounds of methamphetamines in the bag. And you know, I admired him. Someone you can look up. But I also, you know, I wanted him to like me as well. So when I came, you know, when this guy Robbie described it, you know, out of the big book, I started going through that big book and trying to get these directions that he was talking about out of the big book. And there was another guy I hung out with who was like 10 years sober, and he also, I admired how he was. You know, I mean, he was a very big man, but he never made people feel uncomfortable. You know, he was very, very personable, warm person. And the way he lived his life was attractive. And I had these guys that were helping me out with the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at 80 days sober, I had my fourth step completed. And, you know, I wasn't sure. I really didn't want to go to Neil with this fifth step thing because I wanted him to like me. And, you know, there was things I wrote down that, you know, through my perspective at the time, you know, I was a pretty bad person. Some of the things, you know, definitely I could have got a lot of jail time for some of them. But I didn't want Neil to know about this stuff. But I knew that that's how it was laid out in the book. Those were the directions given. So I wanted either Robbie or Marty to hear my fifth step. And they weren't available at the time, and I wasn't sure that the courage that I had to go through with it was going to stay. You know, I could talk myself out of things that are good for me. And, you know, I just didn't know. So Neil was available, and I went with him, and I did my fifth step with Neil. And, you know, amazing thing happened. You know, that fear that was constantly with me, by the way, I was not very honest about it. You know, growing up in Roselle, we had a lot of things. You know, you showed some fear. You pretty much took a beating on a regular basis. And, you know, I wasn't going to do that. You know, I didn't like getting a beating. But I became very good at hiding fears. And I was good at even hiding from myself. You know, I heard mentioned earlier delusional, and that was exactly what it was. I was delusional about a lot of things. My first fourth step, you know, the fear inventory was piss poor, you know. But the rest of it was pretty much as accurate as I could be and as honest as I could be at the time. And it was amazing when I did my fifth step, the freedom I felt. I still had that case and a half of beer stashed. And I know I didn't pay for it, the guys that took off that night. So I gave it back to them like the next day. I mean, I felt that drinking problem had been removed as I did my fifth step. You know, and a lot of the fears left me. And there's fifth step promises in the book that are just amazing. There's third step promises that are amazing too. You know, I mean, going through the process, and a lot of the directions I took were from me reading out of the book and trying to understand what it said and trying to do them. I probably did a little screwy at first, but, you know, I was really persistent in wanting to do them. And when I first read the third step, you know, there's a part in it you could do it with your spiritual advisor, but it's better to do it alone than with one who might misunderstand. I kind of read it as do it yourself, you know, but that's how I did it. But the point is that I did it, you know. I did become convinced that, you know, God could remove this. I was maybe atheist a few years. You know, the first time I was given an AA, not the first time, but when I was looking for AA, I came up to the Westfield Union County Council on Alcoholism. I don't think they're still there where they were, like, years ago. But when I had gotten that Alcoholics Anonymous pamphlet, and it said that you choose your own conception of God, I thought that was just amazing, because I'd been to Catholic school since I was in first grade, and they have their own ideas, and they don't really give you any options on, you know, find God yourself. They have ideas about what God is, and I'm not saying they're bad, but they just, you know, some of the things that they suggested, I just couldn't live with. Even when I was a small kid, they said, God made us all, God loves us all, and if you screw up, he's going to torture you forever. I was like, whoa, where's the love? You know, where'd it go? You just told me about that. But, you know, it just didn't jive with me, you know. I was 5 years old, but I wasn't a moron. So I just dismiss the whole idea of, you know, maybe they're just making this stuff up, you know? They just want you to throw some money in the collection plate or something. I don't know, but it didn't sound right. But Alcoholics Anonymous says, you know, you find your own conception of God. And I was like, holy crap. It was new to me, you know? And I had stopped being an atheist, or I don't know if atheist or agnostic, which one would have more accurately described me. Maybe agnostic, you know? But after I had gotten that bit, I did do this one part where I just asked God to give me a sign. You know, I kneeled down and prayed, and I was in a lot of pain, and I got a sign so immediate that it really freaked me out. I've never done that again. But, you know, I was not a non-believer. So going through with the rest of the steps, you know, there was nothing that would keep me from taking those actions. And I can just say it's just so amazing when you first realize that the obsession to drink is, like, gone. You know, because that was with me, you know, of course, before I started drinking, I didn't have that. I had other symptoms of alcoholism, but that wasn't with me. You know, it probably about when I was 16, I pretty much became an almost daily drinker, although not quite. You know, I'd miss a day here and there. But it pretty much ruled my life. Every decision I made, you know, in my life was, you know, all about beer. And when that obsession was gone, it was so relieving. You know, I stalling on the steps. I mean, the steps are really what's going to save my life. You know, stalling on them, you know, after going through them, it's a little harder to understand why I would stall on it, you know. But before going through it, there's just fears, and just when I wasn't ready, I wasn't ready. It wasn't until I understood that I have, you know, the fatal form of alcoholism, not a mild case like I first thought. It was definitely I got the fatal form. When I realize it's going to kill me, I'm willing to take actions I won't otherwise. And so going through with it, you know, it made perfect sense. So, you know, and all along there's been growth all along, like making the 9-step amends. Some of them I put off for way longer than I should have. You know, for instance, there was this one I did. Now I make direct amends is how the directions read. And I was kind of making indirect amends with my dad. I had a really, you know, really big resentment against my father. And, you know, he was pretty strict. And, you know, he would beat the kids. But when I look back on it, he would only beat me. You know, I was the only one acting like that. You know, my little brother, my sisters, they never got hit. You know, my dad's a really nice guy. He was looking out for me, and I guess he didn't know what he was probably a little annoyed, too, because sometimes, you know, he left a couple marks sometimes, and which wasn't usual for him. But I did this kind of indirect, you know, I took up golf. I was never really crazy about it, but my dad's a golfer, and I became really close friends with them and everything, but I never sat down and, you know, analyzed the past and brought up things like, you know, when I was drinking and I discovered hock shops, I thought it was great. I could just sell my gold. Wait, I don't have any gold, but hey, somebody else does. So I would sell their gold, and I felt really bad about it. I mean, one of my first amends was my sister's. She had gotten this necklace from a guy, and, you know, I helped myself to it. And I kept a lot of felons around the house, so she thought this other guy that I brought over took it, you know. But, in fact, my mother would even warn these people about me, you know. He just did a 6-month stint in jail, and she's saying, you know, you shouldn't hang out with Dennis. He's a bad influence. But she thought someone else took it, and that was one of my first amends. I had gotten, you know, I replaced it. I got a much nicer one. Hers was just gold, and I got a gold one with the pearl and diamonds and everything. And so I took her out to lunch, and I explained that it was me that stole it, and, you know, how can I make this right? And I had another you know, necklace for her. But with my dad, it was his wedding ring. That wasn't something I could just go anywhere and get another ring, you know? So, you know, I didn't know what to do, so I put that off for years, actually sitting down. And what had happened was my dad, he was from Ireland, and, you know, later on in life he became a lot more financially secure than when he first gotten married. And he had gotten a clatter ring, which anyone who's not familiar with Irish jewelry, it's like a hand around the heart, and it's got an emerald in the middle. And, you know, when I did my amends with him, you know, the way it's kind of not the cowardly way I originally started out, when I sat down, I said, look, you know, I stole your wedding ring, because I was pretty sure I couldn't make that up to him, you know. And what can I do to make this right? And he says, you know, I replaced it with the clatter, you know. I never really cared for that ring, you know. And I asked him what I could do to make it right. He says, I just want you to keep doing what you're doing. I like how you are. And he kind of made me feel like I did him a favor by getting rid of that old piece of jewelry, you know. And I carried guilt for that long when, you know, it was just like, it was amazing. It was freeing in a way for me. But, you know, my dad wasn't holding resentments over this stuff, you know. I mean, he was kind of glad I stopped stealing his stuff, and, you know. It was just amazing all the gifts I've been given, and some of the best part is when I get a new guy to work with, and you watch him go through the process, and you watch him come to life. And the way I lived my life was, I affected people in a very bad way when I was drinking. I was selfish and self-centered, and not to say that I'm not sometimes now. You can ask people close to me. Yeah. But I never got the opportunity to affect somebody's life in a positive way is when I sit down and bring someone through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and watch their life turn around and watch the lights come on, and, you know, it's amazing. The difference in my life today is immense. And I guess we're about out of time. And I've been blessed in sobriety to have gone to meetings anywhere from Ireland to Hawaii to Alaska, and this is by far the best meeting that I've ever been to, and I'm really happy to be back to it. And it's just, Jim usually gets better speakers. Anyway, thanks.